The Teaching Saints Virtual Summit was an incredible success. We had thousands of individuals tune in from around the world to hear from people like Brad Wilcox, Hank Smith, Casey Griffiths, Marie Eckersley, Jason Hewlett, Jeff Burke, and more as they taught us about how to better stimulate classroom discussion, create effective classroom environments, best practices with object lessons, and so much more. If you missed the summit, be sure to visit leadinglds.org/teach to watch the three most viewed sessions from the online conference. It will not only change you, but it will change those you teach. Check out the Teaching Saints Virtual Summit today. Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. Hey everyone, this is Kurt Frankum, the host of the Leading LDS podcast. I welcome you back. In this interview, I'm excited to share with you an interview I had with Stephen M.R. Covey. Now, he is the son of the Stephen Covey, which we'll talk about in our interview. But Stephen M.R. Covey is the co-founder of Covey Link and the Franklin Covey Global Speed of Trust Practice, a sought-after and compelling keynote speaker and advisor on trust, leadership, ethics, sales, and high performance. He speaks to audiences around the world. He is the New York Times and number one Wall Street Journal best-selling author of The Speed of Trust, a groundbreaking, paradigm-shifting book that challenges our age-old assumption that trust is merely a soft social virtue and instead demonstrates that it is a hard-edged economic driver, a learnable, measurable skill that makes organizations more profitable, people more promotable, and relationships more energizing. And I loved our discussion where we talked about the principles in this book that all of you leaders listening can definitely benefit from. So here is my interview with Stephen M.R. Covey. Today, I'm in, I believe this is Pleasant Grove, Utah, in the office of Stephen M.R. Covey. How are you, Stephen?
Doing great, Kurt. Nice to be with you.
Can I call you Stephen? Is that
absolutely
okay?
Please do.
Nice. Now, obviously, your name is very familiar to not just individuals within the LDS faith, but anybody who's picked up a business book in the last 100 years probably has heard the name Stephen Covey, and that was your father.
That's right. Nice. Yeah, my father wrote The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which has really been a tremendous leadership book all around the world.
Yeah.
And so I'm his son, and he wrote about me when he told the story about green and clean.
That's what I was going to mention. You're the green and clean son.
I'm green and clean kid. Yeah. I hope I have a chance to tell you my side of the story.
Right. So. Right. Well, it's good to hear you didn't end up in federal prison. So that, those principles took root in your development for sure. What would you say as far as, you know, obviously many people who've read that book are familiar with the green and clean experience, but was it just that, like that day after day in the home of the Coveys growing up, was with the father as an author, a leadership author?
Yeah. No, it was great. And it's really kind of more in retrospect, as I look back on it, I realize that many times the principles my dad was teaching us, that he ended up teaching out there in the marketplace, he first taught us in the home. And I saw these principles in action, you know, the different 7 habits. I saw it first right in the home, you know, seek first to understand, then to be understood. And I saw my dad teaching that, modeling that right in the home first. And in fact, the green and clean story was all about, a win-win agreement, you know, think win-win, and also stewardship delegation. He was trying to teach me how to take responsibility and be accountable and take on the job of, you know, keeping the yard green and clean. And so I grew up with that. It kind of is second nature to me. And so us kids, we like to say that we were the guinea pigs for the 7 habits. We started first with us.
Well, that's great. And obviously you've gone on to establish a career with writing your own book, which is The Speed of Trust, the one thing that changes everything. Do you feel like you just stayed in the family business?
Yeah, kind of. You know, what's interesting, Kurt, is that initially, I was more on the business side. I didn't really have a desire to, or an inclination to write and to do what my dad was doing. So I was just on the business side, helping to build the business, grow the business, expand it around the world. But really over the last little bit, I suddenly felt like I found something that I wanted to say. And that's this whole idea of trust. And so I kind of shifted my career path and went from a business side into more of a thought leadership side, speaking, writing around what I felt was the most important topic for our times, and that is trust and the importance of credit. So in that sense, I've kind of shifted and maybe taken the handoff from my dad and moving down that path now.
So was there a moment that you can pinpoint where you knew that trust was the topic that you were to write on and really travel the world and train on?
Probably not one precise moment, but many, many different moments along the way, ranging from, you know, when I was CEO of Covey Leadership Center, working with two different suppliers on a key product for us, and one of with whom we had high trust and we can count on everything coming from them. The other, that we'd kind of lost that trust, and how because of that lost trust, we had to put in place all these, you know, checks and controls because we didn't fully trust the product coming in. And that took longer and cost more. And I kind of just, you know, just the obvious contrast of working with one of these compared to the other, the difference in the economics, the difference in the speed, the difference in the energy. And I started to say, gosh, there is a high cost to low trust. And then I started to see it everywhere. And once I put the trust glasses on, if you will, I began to see it in any relationship, any team, with clients, with partners. And we saw it in our own business. And when we built trust, we moved fast, low cost, greater creativity, energy, passion. When there was low trust, everything took longer, everything cost more. And so it probably was a process of kind of gaining a lens through which to view the world, through the lens of trust, that once I had that lens on, I now saw it everywhere. And then it became clear that I need to talk about this because people know trust is important, but they've never really put an economic lens to it, of how it affects the speed at which we can move, the cost of everything. And I feel like I could bring that to, you know, this thinking around trust, but also the idea that trust was learnable. It was a learnable skill. We could create it through our credibility, through our behavior. And that's important because many people kind of think you either have it or you don't. And that's your starting point. But in the same way that you can lose trust through your behavior, you can also build it, grow it, expand it through your behavior. In fact, you can get good at this. And that's when I felt like, you know, I have a contribution to make around this topic, that trust is learnable as a skill.
Yeah. And that's, you know, because I think with a value like trust, it's easy to explain on paper, but then you go to the office and try to apply those principles. And sometimes it'd be like, well, yeah, that just won't work here. Or we need to, you know, shave the corner a little bit, that sort of thing. So it sounds like you're making that connection to not just a nice value we can put on our wall, but something that's in our culture, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's in our culture. And I'm trying to bring a new perspective of it, mm-hmm. that it's not just a good thing and a social thing. It's also an economic thing and affects speed and cost. It's also a multiplier of everything that we're doing that makes it better when there's trust. And it's key to leadership because when there's trust in a leader, and when a leader has the trust of his or her team, of the people that they're leading and serving, then there is a different in kind response to that person to anything that they say. I mean, think about communicating. When someone communicates and you don't trust the person, what you hear compared to when someone communicates and you do trust. And one might be the better communicator in terms of technique, but if they're not trusted, people don't hear what they're saying. The other might not have the same level of skill and technique and communication, but everyone trusts that leader. Mm-hmm. It's just a different kind of reaction. And so that's just communication. It applies to every dimension and aspect of leadership at every level, inside the church, outside in society and business, et cetera.
Yeah. And I would imagine some people think, well, yeah, I mean, it's important to have trust when you're running a large organization, but you talk about even on the relationship level, even in marriages, even in family, trust is important.
Absolutely. At every level, the best relationships are those in which people can trust each other, including in the home, including in a marriage, with a family member, with a friend, in the ward, in the community. Trust relationships are just different in kind. And you could love someone and not trust them. Mm-hmm. And so there's really, you know, love is critical, and so is trust. And they can be two different things.
Yeah. You know, that makes puts my mind towards, you know, I interview a lot of leaders, and I just ask them, tell me your, you know, some of your top leadership principles that you live by. And a lot of times they'll say, love. You got to love your people. You know, you got to show love to them and create an environment of love. But if trust isn't there, love can still be present and trust may not be there.
Absolutely. It's possible to have love and to not have trust. Mm. And think of it, your own self. You know, you literally might say, look, this is someone let's say that a leader is dealing with someone that has an addiction or something and trying to help them, and they might completely love that person, but not have full trust yet in that person. Yeah. Or, you know, if a parent dealing with a child that also struggling with an addiction, they might completely love them, but yet not be able to fully trust them.
Yeah.
And yet it doesn't diminish the love that they have.
Right.
And, but I'm reminded of the expression by David O. McKay, who said, it's better to be trusted than to be loved.
Hmm. That's a powerful leadership point.
Yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely.
So, and I love this, you use this analogy throughout the book as far as that fish are the last ones to discover water. And I think that's true in many organizations that you sort of, especially I think of like maybe a newly called bishop or elders quorum president, at least I president, they sort of step in with this idea of like, oh, everybody trusts the bishop. You know, I've sort of been vetted and chosen and asked to serve here. It's not like I applied or I have some ulterior motive of what I'm doing. And so they sort of assume trust is established. So how can we better understand how much trust is there in an organization if we step in as the leader?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you're right. In an institution like the church or another institution where someone is a leader, you might start with a basis of trust, a premise of trust that's kind of built in from the institutional value. But we still need to be very intentional and deliberate about saying, I'm not going to just rely upon position power, you know, formal authority to be the basis of my leadership, which is, you know, I'm the bishop or I'm the leader of the group, I'm whatever the responsibility might be, and rely upon position. Instead, I'm going to rely upon building the credibility, the influence, the moral authority, if you will, the trust that because of who I am, of my character, my competence, and on the character side, you know, my integrity and my intent that I care about those that I'm serving and those that I'm leading, and I'm seeking their best interest, their well-being, and not just saying, I'm the boss, I'm the leader, you know, you need to trust me. But I'm very aware of that. And so in a sense, I'm trying to earn the trust and not just expect that it's there because of my role, my position. So I distinguish between, you know, the position and then what we earn, what we create, what we establish through our credibility and through our behavior. And that's a higher level of trust. And when you align the combination of formal authority with then earned credibility and trust, that's even greater influence that you can have.
Yeah. And because you talk about this concept in the book that sometimes if the previous administration that you're stepping into had a low level of trust, you sort of adopt that and have to, people just default to that same level of trust. And so even your authority or your position may not even come with trust.
It may not come with trust. And if there was a prior leader that somehow had diminished, lost some of the trust, sometimes I call this, that's a tax. It's a low trust tax. Mm-hmm. And you as a new leader coming in might inherit that tax. It's an inheritance tax. You know, you didn't create it, but you inherit it. And so just like there could be an inherited dividend where because of prior leaders and also the institutional buildup, there's trust to begin with. So it can happen in either direction. But the important point is that, you know, to recognize we can move the needle on this, whether we're starting at a good place, which is a great positive, or we're starting in the hole where there's a tax, inherited a tax. But the point is we can earn and create and grow the trust through our credibility and through our behavior. You know, how we do what we do makes all the difference in leadership.
Yeah. And that, so that behavior is really where the focus should be to build trust.
Absolutely. It's got to be really on two key things, Kurt. Trust is built through our credibility and through our behavior. And we're always focusing on our credibility, you know, our personal credibility. And that, you know, the two halves of that, the character half, the competence half. And I can go deeper into those pieces, the character and competence side. And then our behavior, which is how we do what we do. And we're trying to model the behavior that builds trust. And there's a number of different behaviors that will help really accelerate the building of trust. And I highlight that in the Speed of Trust book, the 13 behaviors of high trust leaders at any level, any type of leadership role, that if you do those things, behave in those ways, you'll move the needle on trust. And so, yes, it is a combination of credibility and behavior is how trust is built intentionally.
Yeah. And so how would you summarize that, the importance of character trust and competency trust?
Yes. The combination of the two is credibility. And credibility comes from the Latin term credere. It means to believe. So credibility is believability. Am I believable? Am I credible? If you are, you'll tend to be trusted. If you're not, you'll have a hard time sustaining that trust over time. Even if your position says that, you know, that this person has got the position, but they don't have the credibility, you know, it's hard to sustain the trust. So the, you know, the two halves, the character half, and that's around your integrity and, you know, being truthful, being honest, doing the right thing, preserving confidentiality, if that's the appropriate thing in a given situation, as well as then your intent. Do they think you care? Do they think you care about them? Are you seeking their interest, their well-being, or are you just looking at this through your lens only? And if they don't think you care, sometimes they have a hard time fully trusting. And so you don't have to be perfect, thankfully, but the character trust is important. Then the competence trust is just, you know, are you current? Are you learning, improving, getting better? Again, no one's perfect, especially volunteers. And but we're trying to learn our responsibilities, our duties, and to understand them. And then our results, our performance, that we're trying to deliver and to come through and to do what we say we're going to do so people can rely upon that. And that kind of builds a competence trust. And so equal parts character and competence. And you tend to build it faster on the competence side, but lose it faster on the character side if there's flaws and deficiencies there.
Yeah, just like the you quote Warren Buffett in the book as far as you build your credibility over a lifetime, but lose it in a moment, right?
Yeah.
That's Buffett. Verbatim. But
absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm just, so obviously with those two, with that dichotomy, that it's one thing for a leader to feel like, yeah, you know, I'm a trustworthy guy. I don't really see myself as a liar or that I'm standing up and, you know, twisting information. And so that's one side of it. But if people look at you and they don't see that you're competent in your role, then that damages the trust in general. So it's not just being a good Boy Scout and but it's also showing and developing the skill so that they can trust you in it to lead them.
Absolutely. I mean, think about it. You know, the competence side matters. Now, again, I'll acknowledge in a church setting, in a volunteer organization, where you're responding to a calling that you've been given, and you might be learning those competencies, learning those skills, developing, learning your duties, your responsibilities. So the standard is not perfection, but the standard is learning, getting better, understanding, and then delivering on what you're learning. And so, but, you know, just like in business, someone could be honest and someone could care, but if they don't deliver, if they don't come through, if they don't do what they say they're going to do, you know, you might trust them to watch your home if you went on a vacation, but you might not trust them on the key project, the key client, the key deliverable, if they don't have a track record of performing. And similarly, if we never come through and, you know, we say we're going to get this done and we don't do it, we're going to plan the activity and we don't do it. And gosh, the next time I go to give an assignment to someone that last time they completely dropped the ball, I'm saying, look, it's a nice person. They're honest fundamentally and they care, but I'm reluctant to give them this assignment because why is it going to be different this time? You know, if I don't see them having the, you know, if they don't deliver, if they don't come through, and I need to see the competence side as well as the character side.
Yeah. And I think there's various situations where someone may say, you know, my Relief Society president, she's such a wonderful woman. I love her so much and she cares, but I'm not sure I don't want to go talk to her about, you know, difficult situations in my life, or I don't know if she could handle that or wouldn't know what to say. Right. And so as a leader, it's sort of a good opportunity to step back and say, and measure yourself. How am I doing in these two areas? And, you know, how are people perceiving me? Do I need more work on the character side or do I need more work on the competence side? And I think the character side, generally just the natural vetting process that takes place, that's sort of already installed.
It's kind of already installed in the church and with good people.
Yeah.
Kind of already doing well there. And sometimes it's a matter of really kind of getting better on the competence side.
Yeah.
And that could be learning our duties, learning or and developing more skills and more expertise in different areas that could be of value to people.
Yeah. And absolutely. That's the leader I think we all want to follow, is someone who really cares about us. And I think we've all had this where you just feel like they know you, they care about you, but they seem really competent too. So you'd march in any battle with them with those two characteristics.
Absolutely. The competence also inspires. Character clearly does. And the lack of it will sink it every time.
Yeah.
But the competence can be kind of a differentiator of why I'll go further and farther with a given leader and why I respond to them more, because I really feel like they're not only a good person, but they can really make things happen and get things done. And
yeah.
It just goes to another level.
Yeah. Anything else with this? Obviously, you could write a book on it, which you have, about this character and competency that we haven't hit that would be important to talk about before we move on? Or
yeah, I think we've hit the main thing. And that, and I think this is something that in the church in particular, but also in our society, we recognize the importance of kind of this credibility, particularly the character half and the integrity. And so we're singing to the choir,
right,
much
yeah,
of that.
Yeah.
The added dimension is also bringing to it the competence piece,
yeah,
and how the combination increases credibility, which is a better thing than just relying upon position power.
Yeah.
I want to rely upon credibility of me as a leader,
yeah,
and as a person, both halves.
Yeah.
That's a better thing than I'm reverting back to my position.
Yeah. And it makes me think of in a mentoring situation. You know, obviously in the church, we don't request a resumes from around the world when we need a new elders quorum president. We have a geographical neighborhood typically where we can pick from. And we may call someone who's very, you know, has great character, but we think, ah, man, you know, how can I help them? Well, you can focus on their capability side and develop them there. And then that's what will help them develop as a leader.
Absolutely. That will help them. And again, you don't have to be perfect. We just have to be willing, right?
Yeah. Willing. That's such an important point.
Yeah. Yeah.
That we're not looking for perfect people that are really awesome leaders and dynamic leaders. We can work with anybody just as long as they're willing to try.
Right. And that's why we have training. And we're trying to learn our duties and learn how to get better at doing our duties,
yeah,
and understanding them and being a more effective leader this way. But there's a huge leverage opportunity here if we can complete the full round of credibility. So it's,
yeah,
not just character-based, it's also competence-based. That's the opportunity.
Awesome. Awesome. You know, I chuckle at there's one point in the book where you talk about this dynamic when you go out and speak and individuals come up to you and say, wow, you know, this is great, great stuff. I agree with everything. You know, who really needs to hear this is my boss. And then you go to their boss and teach the same training. Oh, you know, who really needs to hear this is our executive team. Right. And so as people listen to this, I think it's easy to just passively sit by and think,
yeah,
oh boy, my bishop needs, or my stake president really needs to hear this. Cause that's exactly why I don't trust him, you know? But and you quote your father is, if you think the problem is out there, the very thought is the problem, right? You always have to turn inward and say, what if it's me that people aren't trusting, right?
Absolutely. And the tendency, human nature is kind of to look out there at everybody else. And there are issues out there all around us. But that very thinking disempowers us. And we've got to look in the mirror. And, you know, is it I?
Yeah.
As the expression goes from the scripture, is it I? And to look in the mirror, start there, and then we ripple out. And so I like the airline metaphor, you know, where it says, if we lose cabin pressure, oxygen mask will fall down. And then it says, put your own mask on first before helping others.
Yeah.
So yeah, we want to help others, and other people need this. They need to, you know, be more credible themselves and more trustworthy. But the best way we'll help them is to model it. Let's put our own mask on first, then we can help others. And I'll tell you what, it's just human nature to wait on everybody else. We do surveys where we have teams measure the trust on the team, and they measure how they see themselves around the credibility dimensions, character and competence. And inevitably, they say, I'm doing really well. Then they assess other members of the team, how they're doing. And, you know, and there's 20, 30, 40, 50 point gaps on,
yeah,
how they see them doing. The very people that rated themselves so high,
yeah,
you know, but... So it remains a real challenge for most people everywhere. Yeah.
So what do you tell someone who's in an organization who they feel like those above them are, they can't trust them. They're having a hard time trusting even those that they're trying to lead. And they just feel like the whole organization is, you know, not that it's an evil organization, but there's just a huge deficit of trust there. How can we move forward with that so while still looking inward?
Yeah. Well, that's the key point. First, look inward to say, what can I do to give to this organization a leader who they can trust so that it's smart to trust me? How can I focus on my credibility, my character, my competence? Always start there. Then what are some things I can do specifically to begin to change the dynamic and to begin to create more trust through my initiation of it. And some of those things that you can do as a leader, you know, include this: to declare your intent. To, you know, you let your, the people that you're leading, people that you're serving, you come and you say, hey, look, here's my intent for this. Here's what I'm trying to do. Here's why. I not only give the what, I give the why. Always give the why. The why gives meaning. The why gives context. The why can change everything. Give the why. You know, here's my agenda. Here's my motive. It's not hidden. It's open. It's transparent. And I declare it. So I come in and I say, you know, if I'm the leader of the ward, if I'm the bishop, you know, council, here's what we're trying to do. Here's why. Here's our agenda. We're trying to create this kind of atmosphere. Why? Because we're trying to, you know, lead people to help them, you know, build strong families and to do these things. And we give the why behind the what. We lead out with it. We declare our intent. And that just gives people a new lens through which they can view our subsequent behavior. And that's a powerful thing. Another powerful thing to build trust when there's not enough trust is to extend trust to people. And it sounds almost like a paradox, right? Maybe you don't trust them, but one of the fastest way to build trust is to give trust, because there's a reciprocity of trust. And when you give it, people receive it and they return it. And when you withhold it, they tend to withhold it. And the leader's job is to go first. And, you know, someone needs to go first. That's what leaders do. Leaders go first. Yes, there's a risk to trust, but there's a risk not to trust. And here's what I found kind of as an overall assessment in the church, and is that we really are good at understanding trustworthiness, the importance of trustworthiness. And that's the credibility piece, you know, be trustworthy, especially the character side, be trustworthy. We're not always as good at understanding the importance of extending trust, of giving trust, of trusting people. And to have trust, you need both the trustworthiness, the credibility, but also the extension of trust. And what's interesting, Kurt, is that you could have two trustworthy people working together and no trust. If neither party is willing, neither person is willing to extend it to the other. And so there has to be, to have trust, you need to be both trustworthy, credibility, but also you need to give it, you need to extend it. That act of extending trust is an act of leadership. And it was Neil Maxwell who said, it is better to trust and sometimes be disappointed than to be forever distrusting and be right occasionally. So yeah, there's a risk to do it, but it's okay. It's better to take that risk in a smart way than to, you know, say, look, I can't trust people until they prove that I can. I think it's better to say, I trust you until prove that I can't or shouldn't.
I love that, because it gives a real starting point for a lot of leaders that if they don't know, if they're in an organization that maybe isn't as trustworthy as they'd like, the first step is to start trusting those around you.
Start trusting those around you. Wow. The quickest way, there's an expression somewhere, I think it was Henry Simpson, former U.S. Secretary of State, he said something to this effect: the quickest way to make a person trustworthy is to trust them and give them the opportunity. And the quickest way to make them untrustworthy is to tell them you don't trust them and demonstrate it in your actions. Because then they tend to live down to that expectation of, you know, I saw this with a parent and his son. And the dad was always on his son's case of, you know, how come I can't trust you and you're not trustworthy? And then the son made a mistake and he said, why'd you do that? And he said, and the son said, because dad, that's the way untrustworthy kids behave. You know, and he kind of labeled them that way. And the son lived down to the label. But they also can live up to it. You know, don't treat people according to their behavior. Treat people according to their potential. And, you know, and so you treat them of, I trust you. And you can do this. I believe in you. I affirm you. I trust you. And they tend to rise up to that. Now, you don't want to be naive with it, blind with it. But as a leader, you know, you tell those that you're leading and serving, I trust you to take on this job, this calling, this responsibility. You can do this. I trust you to do it. That, and, you know, express it in the words of trust. Don't just say, this is, you're called to this. Say, I trust you to take this on. And here's what we're looking for. And I always, so one of the behaviors that builds trust is to extend it. But when you extend the trust, there's two key other behaviors to add to it. I mean, I'm giving you some of the 13 behaviors here. I'm not going to give them all, but give a few. The one I wanted to start with was extending trust, and always add two other behaviors to it. Clarify expectations and practice accountability to those expectations. If I do that, then when I'm extending trust, I'm clear about what I'm extending trust on. Here's what we're trying to do. Here's your responsibility. Here's what the results we're after. Here's the guidelines and to work within and the resources that we have. And here's how we'll be accountable to those results, how you'll return a report, if you will, of how you did against the stewardship that we gave. And that way people can judge themselves. They can evaluate themselves against what we've mutually agreed upon. So if I've got someone that's in charge of the activities and I say, okay, you're the activity chair, or, you know, what are we trying to accomplish? We're trying to do, you know, great ward activities that involve the members of the ward and that foster, you know, love and social cohesion and get people to know each other. And, you know, that's what we're after. The guidelines, the resources, we got so much in the budget. We got all these people on a committee. You can add more people to the committee. And then in terms of being accountable to these guidelines, I want you to, you know, we'll meet 3 times a year and report back how you're doing against this and what we can do better. You judge yourself. And, you know, you can do this in home teaching. You can do this in any stewardship, any responsibility. Yeah. You extend trust with clear expectations and an agreed upon process for accountability to those expectations where they report back and evaluate themselves against what you've mutually agreed to. That's so much better than you having to hover over and saying, hey, how come you didn't do this? How come you didn't do that? And then they feel micromanaged. Yeah. And they say, do you trust me or not? Yeah. And you're saying, well, I want to make sure this happens, but set it all up front.
Yeah.
You know, in stewardship delegation, in a win-win performance agreement, in a real smart trust delegation
yeah.
of responsibility. And that will make it more powerful.
I love that. And I've talked to several leaders who are sort of getting this feeling like, you know, I've asked my ward council to do this. I've asked the elders of my quorum to do this, but they just always let me down and it's not happening. And so it's easy to just place the blame on them. But what I'm learning from what you're saying is that to step back and look at how well am I setting expectations and how well am I following up with accountability? If you have those two things in place, that trust will build and things will start to happen, sounds like.
Absolutely. It's a far greater way. And also, you'll leverage yourself. When you don't have those things in place, you'll end up micromanaging quite a bit. You'll be checking in on them a lot because you're worried they're not clear on what you're supposed to be doing. Yeah. And then when you kind of are checking in on them, they'll feel like you don't trust them and you're micromanaging them. But you're trying to make sure that they're being accountable. But we often haven't done a good enough job up front of doing this well. It takes a little bit longer, but you do it well, then suddenly they report back to you against what you've agreed to. They feel better about it. Uh-huh. They tend to be tougher on themselves than you'll ever be and what they could do better and how they can improve. And they feel empowered. They feel you trust them and they perform better and they return the trust back to you. They trust you more.
Yeah.
And so it's a virtuous upward cycle that more trust and confidence is created. And the key is to spend the time up front to do it. It takes you longer up front, but in the long run, you go so much farther, faster. When you don't do it, you end up micromanaging and people feel hovered over and they also don't feel trusted and they tend to not trust you back as much.
Yeah. You know, when you use that term empowered, it jumped out because the number one question I get or concern that we hear at leading LDS is, I don't know how to motivate people. They seem like they don't want to jump in and help me, but this process empowers them. And if you're looking how to develop motivation, it's developing trust through this process.
I would say this, Kurt, to be trusted is the most inspiring form of human motivation. Hmm. It brings out the best in people. They want to be worthy of that trust. They rise to the occasion, especially good people.
Yeah.
They don't want to let you down. Green and Clean is a trust story.
Yeah.
I was 7 years old. I didn't know what stewardship delegation was.
Yeah.
So that was words and a win-win performance agreement. You know, my dad talks about that, but what I knew as a 7-year-old was that my dad trusted me.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to let him down.
Yeah.
And so I took responsibility for taking care of the yard. This is back in the days before they had automatic sprinklers. You know, I had to manually do this. But the yard was green and it was clean as a 7-year-old boy because he trusted me. And that is a powerful form of motivation. It's the most inspiring form. And so, yes, I call it, you know, we need to move from a style of leadership that's more traditional, hierarchical, command and control, you know, position power. I'm the leader and, you know, I'm delegating this out. To one of trust and inspire. Mm-hmm. And I trust my people. I trust my team. And together we come up with what we're trying to accomplish, how we know how we're doing, what we have to work with, and how we'll be accountable to it. And I put the onus on you to report back on their accountability, not on me to check on you.
Yeah.
And it's a game changer. And people feel better and they respond to the stewardships. I saw this in leadership responsibilities I've had in church settings, where by really trusting people and then creating the equivalent of, you know, of a win-win agreement, of a smart trust agreement, of clear expectations, agreed upon process of how they'll report back on their accountability to those expectations, they perform better. They deliver more and they trust me more because I trust them and they reciprocate that trust. And so I've seen that happen time and again. So those are, you know, kind of three behaviors in one: extend trust. And within that context, make sure you clarify expectations and practice accountability, have a process for that. And that will be a smart trust. If you extend trust without clear expectations or agreed upon process for accountability, it could be a blind trust that ultimately will kind of get revoked and will turn into people feeling distrusted or micromanaged.
Wow, that's powerful. And as you mentioned in the book, a large part of the book is you going over these 13 behaviors of trust. And that's helpful because it gives you sort of a game plan to, okay, this trust principle is great, but how do we apply it? And so you've talked about with demonstrate trust and practice accountability. Was that the two? Or
extend trust and then two
extend trust.
Clarify expectations, practice accountability.
Okay, there it is. Clarify expectations, practice accountability. Anything else with those two that need to be hit on?
Well, those two are really, they work together in tandem
okay. To
make smart trust smart. But let me highlight, if I could, two more
great
behaviors, Kurt. Again, this is coming from my list of 13.
Yeah. So you got to read the book if you want all 13. It's a good read.
I will say this, that, you know, outside research has validated that if you behave in these 13 ways and also build on the foundation of credibility, the data shows that it will predict literally and explain 100% of the trust on a team.
Oh, wow.
And 97% of the trust inside of an organization. In other words, this is valid and reliable. And, you know, so I'm just saying that it works, that these behaviors actually do build the trust. There's hard data behind it.
Cool.
But I'll highlight two more behaviors that are really important for any leader, whether it be a bishop leading a ward council or, you know, a president leading her presidency and in Relief Society or Young Women's or wherever. And that is, you know, we really want to counsel and we want our councils to be collaborative. And not just, you know, information sharing or not just coordinating councils. We really want collaborating, you know, that are really bringing out the best in people, their best thinking, their best ideas, their best input. And there's two key behaviors as the leader to get really good at. That if you lead out doing this really well, it'll make a difference. And I'm going to put them together. Listen first and then demonstrate respect for what you hear. And the whole idea here is that, you know, so you're opening it up. You're coming to your council and you say, hey, you know, council, here's what we're trying to do. Here's our objective. Here's our motive. So let me listen. I want to hear. I want to understand what people are thinking, what's going on in your world and what you're seeing happen. Let me listen. Let me understand. And if we take the approach of listening first, and sometimes as leaders, we feel like we need to have the answers. Mm-hmm. So we come in and say, here's what I think's happening. You know, what do you think? But sometimes your position, you come in as the leader, the boss, I'm saying this, what do you think? Sometimes people are a little reluctant to really tell you what they think. They might not think you'll understand. They might be afraid to tell you. It might be something you don't want to hear. And also, you know, they might be deferential to you. And especially when you lead out saying, here's what I think, what do you think? And you got the position power and they might be a little bit timid on this. You might not hear what they think. If you can find the better way to say, what do you think? And listen first. And then when you listen, don't judge it initially. Don't evaluate it initially. Don't necessarily agree or disagree. Just first try to understand. So you say, let me make sure I understand what you're saying. Am I understanding this? You're just capturing it. And you're reflecting back what you heard. You're reflecting back both the content of what you heard, but also the feeling and the emotion behind what you heard. And, you know, so you're rephrasing content and reflecting feeling in a way of understanding, not judging, not agreeing or disagreeing, not evaluating, not interpreting. That's all autobiographical. Instead, you're saying, let me see if I understand right. Here's what I hear you saying. Is this right? Am I capturing this well? They say, well, yeah, but you kind of missed the main point, which was how people feel about this. And so this is all a process of demonstrating respect for what you hear. And if you do those two behaviors together, listen first and demonstrate respect for what you hear, what's going to happen is you're going to hear a whole lot more people talking and saying what they really feel, because they won't feel immediately judged or evaluated or shot down. They'll feel like you listen, and not only do you listen, but you understand. See, most people listen not with the intent to truly understand. Rather, most people listen with the intent to reply and to respond. So they're patient. They say, yeah, good point, Seth. Yeah, now here's what I think we should, but the person might not feel understood.
Yeah.
Instead, to say, let me make sure I understand what I hear you saying. And you can do it in a way that's not, doesn't feel trite or, you know, rote, going through the motions, but really you're trying to get into their world to have them feel, thank you, Bishop. I feel understood.
Yeah.
And the test of understanding is not when you tell the person, hey, I understand you. No, it's when they tell you, I feel understood.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to me. Yeah. And maybe that was the first time they've ever felt understood in that setting or in this role. So if you get really good at that, listen first, demonstrate respect for what you hear. Those two behaviors are great behaviors to build trust and also to get more openness, more authenticity, more collaboration, people talking straight and telling the truth and saying what they really think and not just, you know, giving, you know, what everyone wants to hear. And you'll get more real and you'll go farther with it. But also you'll really have an impact on them. You'll inspire people this way more. You'll motivate them more when they feel understood.
Yeah, it's so validating to be in that relationship with a leader that you feel like they really are hearing you, that they're understanding you, and it's validating.
Yes, it's like it's giving people psychological air. I mean, here we are, Kurt, in this room. If we were to suck the oxygen out of the room, you wouldn't care what I were saying, and I wouldn't care either. We both would just be fighting for air, right?
Right, yeah.
You know, but when you have air, it doesn't motivate, but a satisfied need doesn't motivate. But if I'm like a leader in the council or in the ward, but I don't feel understood, I don't feel like anyone's listening to me, I'm fighting for air.
Yeah.
And if you listen and understand me to my satisfaction and show respect versus judgment and evaluation, that's like giving someone air. And it's just like relieving. I can let down. I can get more real and authentic, and it's simple, but it's so powerful. So there's 13 behaviors, but I've given, you know, 5 key ones. Yeah. Extend trust and tell people that you're extending the trust. Then in the process of extending trust, make sure it's smart with clear expectations and an agreed upon process to be accountable to those expectations. So expectations and accountability. And then as the leader, as you go into your councils, or as you go into a one-on-one meeting, whether it be, you know, a PPI or a private meeting with someone, always listen first, demonstrate respect for what you hear. And then you'll be in a better position to advise, to counsel, to serve, to collaborate if you do that in that sequence. But don't try to get into the advice too soon, especially when you have the position, because people often will defer to the position, and too often we shortcut those steps.
Yeah.
The listening is we listen, but we don't understand and people don't feel understood. So listen with the intent to truly understand. It will be a powerful game changer for any leader.
Yeah, that's helpful. And I was kind of a question to wrap up. I was going to ask is where can leaders start to really, if they don't know where to start, where should they start? And with these principles, that's a good foundation to start building trust.
I hope so. I think that I would say, where can you start? Always start by looking in the mirror. And even if you feel like there's problems outside of you, it's others. If you look in the mirror, you'll be in a better position to know how to do it. And then what you can do is you can, you know, give those that you're working with and those that you're leading, those that you're serving, a leader that they can trust through your character, your competence, your credibility. And then you lead out with a couple key things, couple key actions. First, you declare your intent. So you're on the record with who you are, what you're about, what matters to you, and why. And so that no one's questioning your agenda, your motive. You don't have a hidden agenda. It's an open agenda. And you're transparent and you declare it. And people see it. They see you have a new lens through which they can view you. And then, so that's one, declare your intent and lead out by extending trust to others. And be smart about it, meaning clear expectations, agreed upon process for accountability, those two other behaviors. But someone needs to go first. Leaders go first. Yeah, there's a risk to trust, and there's a greater risk not to trust. And, you know, and I really believe we need more trust, more extension of trust. We understand trustworthiness in the church. We often don't understand enough about the importance of extending trust, giving trust, trusting our team, trusting our people, and telling them that we trust them, empowering them with clear expectations and accountability, and letting them report back on their stewardships, not us hovering over them. And if we get good at that, you watch. It will inspire them. They'll motivate them. And they'll rise to the occasion and they'll return the trust back to us.
Awesome. Well, obviously people should, you know, they can find the book very easily online. I got my copy at Amazon and it worked very well. Other than jumping into the book, is there, if people really want to understand these concepts, the various principles you talk, anything you would suggest other than going out and checking out the book?
Well, the book is a great starting point. There's also some, you know, there's a website, speedoftrust.com. It has all kinds of other tools that people can use, and there's some videos and again, much of that is applied to an organizational setting that might be different than what they're in here, but mm-hmm. they can apply the same principles in any leadership context, because by definition, a principle applies in any context, mm-hmm. and it applies to a person, it applies to a relationship, it applies in a home, it applies in a family, it applies in a community, applies in church, applies in a business, in a healthcare system, in education, in government, in all of life. And so there's a variety of different tools that are available at speedoftrust.com is another resource for people.
Perfect. And the last question I typically ask, and again, if this question is too much, let me know. But as you've gone throughout your life and really in your professional life, dedicating your research and your focus on this value of trust, how has that made you a better disciple of Jesus Christ?
I've learned this, that I can have a complete and full trust in God and Christ, an absolute trust because of their character and competence. The God can't lie, loves his children, his intent is pure, has all power, all knowledge, and his promises are true. Therefore, there's absolute credibility, not relative, but absolute. So I can have absolute trust. And also, just like the scripture that says in the New Testament, we love him because he first loved us. I believe that that is true. And we're a better disciple when we respond to the love that comes to us first by loving back. I think the same is true. We trust him because he first trusted us. And it comes back that way and goes full circle.
That concludes my interview with Stephen M. R. Covey. So gracious for him to sit down and to discuss some of these principles. I love this book. I've read it multiple times. I encourage you to go check out The Speed of Trust and dive in and see what you can learn from the principles taught therein. If you know of any other author or speaker that I should reach out to and invite onto the Leading LDS podcast, please let me know at leadinglds.org/contact, and there we can make steps to set it up. And don't forget, visit leadinglds.org/teach to check out the three most viewed sessions from the recent Teaching Saints Virtual Summit. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership. from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.